On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I want you to realize that you've got nothing to prove, and that whoever doesn't know who you are, and whoever is afraid of you, is to be pitied. But I beg you not to hate him. As for who is innocent and who is guilty, nobody knows. Nobody knows. That's the point.
James Baldwin speaking to high school students in Oakland in 1963. After a week of violence, KCRW DJ Aaron Byrd didn't start his show on Friday morning with music. He began with clips from Baldwin's appearance that day. His show touched a nerve with our listeners, and he's giving us a press play version of it in a bit. But first, a conversation about the national mood right now. Last week started with the shooting deaths of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile in Minnesota at the hands of cops. It ended with the shooting deaths of five police officers in Dallas at a protest over the Sterling and Castile killings. Given what's happening across the country, many of us in Los Angeles can't help but think back to times like the Watts riots of 1965, the Rodney King riots of 1992, and the O.J. Simpson trial of 1994. How far have we come since those times, and how has policing here in L.A. changed? Carl E. Douglas is a longtime L.A. civil rights lawyer specializing in police misconduct cases, and it's very good of you to join us today.
Barbara, thanks for having me on.
Well, I know a lot of people, especially young people, are wondering right now, has it ever been this bad before in terms of racial tension and violence? What's your take on that, your long take?
Well, it certainly has been worse than this, but because of the advent of social media and technology, these things that occur are now coming to the public consciousness so much more. But I think it's a good thing, Barbara, because it forces us to have a conversation. Today, everyone is feeling pain, pain for those that died, as you've said, and pain for those brave police officers as well out of Dallas, Texas.
Social media, though, also comes under a lot of criticism, and there's a lot of finger-pointing, and also at the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement, at bloggers and voices on social media, they get blamed for escalating violence and hate speech. So how do you weigh that with the good that things like capturing police misconduct on videos and going viral, the good that that does in keeping law enforcement accountable?
Barbara, it's going to be the new reality, I think, and we as a people are going to have to become accustomed to it. We're going to have to be able to synthesize and to weed out and to balance, hopefully. One of the good things about technology is now everyone has a video camera basically in their hip pocket. I've been handling cases involving allegations of police misconduct for almost 36 years, and people are asking me how there has been this rash of police shootings or police beatings, and I tell them, basically, to welcome to my world. There has not been a great dramatic increase. There's just been the opportunity now that more and more of these encounters are being captured, not only by the cell phone videos out of Minnesota, for example, but also from the body cameras that are becoming more and more prevalent among law enforcement agencies across the country.
But what people are also struggling with is that have we ever seen anything like the Dallas shooting before?
Probably not, and I think that is what has certainly forced white America to join this conversation. It is unfortunate and ironic that it took or takes the death of five police officers, as tragic as that is, to force white America to join this conversation that Black America and brown America have been engaging in for years. Certainly, all lives matter, and the deaths of all 7 lives that have taken place over the last week or so should be the subject of national conversation.
Well, let's talk specifically about the LAPD and its history, since you know so much about it. Our police department has a racist past dating all the way back to the 60s. When the department was at its most abusive, whenever you place that, how did that play out on the streets? And I'm trying to make this connection between what's different now with social media and how it's affecting how people protest.
Sure. Well, first of all, the history and the troubling history of the African-American community and the Los Angeles Police Department even predates the Watts riots in 1965. There was a Chief Parker, a chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, for whom Parker Center was named, and he was at best racially insensitive, and certainly many would have called him one who commanded in a certainly racially offensive manner. That created a certain culture that is still regrettably lingering to this day. There have been the highlighted problems that we've discussed in 1965. There was the case of Leonard Detweiler in the mid-60s that really brought Johnny Cochran's to fame. There was the case of Eula Love in the late 70s. Of course, Rodney King happened in 1992. The verdict led to the uprising in 93 after the 4 officers were found not guilty by an all-white jury in Simi Valley. And there have been other incidences since then as well that have really helped to highlight the troubling history and the sense of distrust that many African Americans have for police officers in urban areas across this nation. It's not just a unique problem to Los Angeles, but in urban areas across the country, it's more of the same.
Now, I do want to get to the fact that you were featured in the ESPN documentary O.J. Made in America, which documents not only the O.J. Simpson case, but the whole history of LAPD racism and racial tension in the city. And you're speaking to that now, and sadly, it seems so relevant now. But you were featured because you were part of O.J.'s defense team, and you worked for the Cochran firm at the time. And the defense essentially exploited the LAPD's racist history in service of someone who was not a victim of that racism. So I'm curious if you have any regrets about that, given where we are now.
Barbara, certainly no regrets that I, as a lawyer, did my best to defend someone who was charged with a crime. That one of the central police officers in that investigation had a racist past was a piece of evidence that I, as an advocate, was bound to explore and to exploit if it were to reasonably be admissible in a way that could benefit my client. Whether it was O.J. Simpson or anyone else would not matter because those issues and that cop's background is still the same. The fact that we found or proved that officers lied under oath, whether it's O.J. Simpson or no J. Simpson, is still a terrible indictment on our criminal justice system that we all must look into the mirror about.
Carly Douglas, he's a longtime L.A. civil rights lawyer specializing in police misconduct cases. And thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.
Barbara, my pleasure. Please have me back again.
I would hope to. Alton Sterling was killed in Louisiana on Tuesday. Philando Castile was killed in Minnesota on Wednesday. And on Thursday, Micah Xavier Johnson killed 5 police officers in Dallas. That night, KCRW DJ Aaron Bird headed to the station for his weekly show. And shortly after he went on the air, he posted on Facebook, "Curtis, Gil, Dead Prez, James Baldwin, and Malcolm speeches. Yeah, it's going to be that kind of show yet again." Here's Aaron now with some tracks from that night and his thoughts about the choices he made.
When I got to the station, I went through my normal routine of preparing for the show, and something just didn't feel right. So around, I'm pretty sure it was about 11:26 or so, I just decided, you know what, I'm going to have a show that just sort of reflects the range of emotions and sentiments that a lot of us are feeling. And I wanted to start the show off with something from James Baldwin. The first thing you hear is an announcer reciting a question that one of the students poses to James Baldwin. James Baldwin, in this speech, is talking to a group of high school students in Oakland in 1963.
The first question Mr. Baldwin was asked, do you think that black people in America should learn African history and culture to gain pride and dignity and strength? So when we are confronted by white people, we can say that we have a culture which is at the very least equal to white people's, and at the very most, well, we're not sure what it's equal to.
I can say, first of all, yes. Yes. But be careful. Find out all you can. But don't find it out with the intention of proving a point. Understand this. There is no reason for you to prove yourself to anybody except yourself. When the world talks about culture, understand this. It is not talking about culture. It is talking about power. The difference between the African cultures, which have vanished, and the European cultures, which are decaying, is that Europe had the power. And that is the only difference. It is not that Europe was civilized and Africans were not. That's a lie. Do you understand that? And find out all you can about what happened when you got here. But you haven't got to prove it to anybody. All you got to do is know it. You're a man, baby.
No, as far as everything else that I played throughout the show, I was literally picking the next song as the current song was playing. So for instance, immediately following the James Baldwin, I played Gil Scott-Heron, Did You Hear What They Said?
Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said they shot him in his head.
Another song I chose is by Curtis Mayfield, We the People Who Are Darker Than Blue. And part of the reason why I chose that particular song is because in it, he is talking to the black community in America and goes into great detail about how we should treat each other with a bit more dignity and respect. And once that is accomplished, perhaps at that moment in time, other peoples will treat us with a bit more dignity and respect.
We people who are darker than blue, are we gonna stand around this town and let what others say come true? We're just good for nothing, they all figure, a boyish grown-up shiftless jigger. Now we can't hardly stand for that. Or is that really where it's at?
So I also included a speech by Malcolm X. It's titled American Courts. The passion in which you hear Malcolm X speak about how black folks aren't giving equal opportunity in the eye of the law. And as far as justice is concerned, I thought it was quite important to have something in the show that also reflected that side of the emotions that people were feeling as a result of everything that happened last week.
The only way you get justice is in the street. The only way you get justice is in the sidewalk. The only way you get justice is when you make justice for yourself. You never will get justice in the white man's court. No, not me. I never want him to take me to court. I saw what he did with my brothers. I see what he has done with them right here in New York City. So make sure you obey the law. Make sure you never commit a crime. Make sure you never deviate from the law. But any time one of them puts his hands on you, take him off the planet. Take him off the planet.
Yeah, I also felt it was important to play KRS-One's Sound of the Police.
Stand clear, done, man, I talk. You can't stand where I stand, you can't walk where I walk. Watch out, we run New York. Policeman come, we bust him out the park. I know this for a fact, you don't like how I act. You claim I'm selling crack, will you be doing that? I'd rather say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be your officer, your wicked overseer.
I think I was about 11 or 12 years old when that first came out. And I have such a distinct memory of a line he has in the song where he says, overseer, 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 officer.
Overseer, 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 officer, 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 officer.
And it blew my mind the first time I ever heard that. I had never sort of put that link together. So I ended the show with Marvin Gaye, Inner City Blues, Make Me Wanna Holler. Again, just a timely song that clearly reflects how some people were feeling about all of the events that transpired last week. I can't say that I had any aspirations as to how this may have affected people. What I can say is my program is the tool that I use in my art form. So like other artists, they use a canvas of sorts or clay or metal or a basketball to express themselves. And that's exactly what I wanted to do with the show. I know so many people were feeling the same exact way that I was. And I gotta tell you, the response I received has been beyond overwhelming. And it's nice to see that people really appreciated what I did. It's unfortunate how much it was really needed.
Aaron Bird can be heard here on KCRW Friday mornings from midnight to 3. You can find a link to last weekend's set and a complete track list on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. And Aaron will be hosting KCRW's next free Sound and Focus concert with Senegalese great Baba Mall at the Annenberg Center for Photography next Saturday night. Hope you can join.
Fact is, oh, honey, did I can't pay my taxes.
Is there a song you listen to that helps you process troubled times or that makes you feel better? Call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or you can reach out on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Well, coming up, if you see people wandering around holding their phones up in front of them, they're not lost. They're likely playing the latest big thing in mobile phone scavenger hunt games. It's called Pokemon Go, and it's wreaking some havoc on the streets. Here's a warning, maybe don't play Pokemon Go while driving. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcasts you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. If you see roving groups of people walking around very slowly with their eyes glued to their cell phones this week, Well, I guess that's nothing new, actually. But what is new, the sheer number of them has increased because of a new cell phone game called Pokemon Go. And bear with me here. It's an augmented reality app. You hold up your phone with the game on, and little Pokemon characters appear in the street view on your phone. For instance, let's say you're dropping your kid off at school and you're playing the game, and you could see a little orange Charizard dragon-type creature lurking in the bushes on your screen view of the schoolyard. And then you can go over to those bushes to get close to its geolocation, and you can capture the Pokemon. The goal is to collect as many of these creatures as possible. Sounds like fun. We'll see what it's what effect it has on society. Joining us now to explain all of this is Max Reed, senior editor of the Select All Tech blog at New York Magazine. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, I'm fine, but I really did a bad job, I think, explaining the game in that intro. Can you give us the basics?
Sure. So, you know, like any Pokemon game, which I think anybody under 30 and anybody who has a child who's under 30 is familiar with, the basis of the game is trying to catch these little monsters called Pokemon that are wandering around the world. The difference between this game and games you play on your Game Boy or on the N64 is that it happens on your phone, and it more or less happens in real life. So you take the phone out. The initial view is a sort of map that matches your city or your town, and you walk around, and little Pokemon will pop up on the map. And you press on them, and you'll be taken into what's called sort of an augmented reality view. So you hold up your phone, and you see through the camera lens the world around you, and there on the sidewalk in front of you is a Pikachu or a Squirtle or a Charizard. And you throw Pokeballs to capture them, and the goal of the game is to capture Pokemon and to win. It's sort of like King of the Hill. You want to win what are called gyms in your city or your town on behalf of one of three teams that you can join, red, blue, or yellow.
Right, and by catching them, by throwing Pokeballs, you mean you make this kind of movement with your finger, like a little flick. That helps you capture them.
Swipe the phone. You're not throwing anything real, hopefully.
Right. Now, is this the first augmented reality game to really go big time, to go fully mainstream?
Yeah, I would say so. Now, the developer of this game is a company called Niantic, which is a Google offshoot, and they had a game called Ingress, which was popular but not mainstream. And in fact, Pokemon Go builds a lot on some of the gameplay of that game, which is the walking around, the ability to claim certain locations, the ability to see real-life locations and make use of them within the game. What Pokemon has going for it is this enormously popular cartoon that has about 20 years worth of nostalgia built into it.
So how many people really are actually playing Pokemon Go? And one of them is clearly my producer, who's been catching Pokemon all over the station today. And I'm seeing a lot of funny people spots filling up my social media feed of where people are playing this.
I don't have a firm number, but I can tell you that like on certain platforms, on Android, it appears to be surpassing Twitter in daily active users. It's bigger than Tinder in certain ways. It's the most downloaded app in all the app stores. And, you know, anywhere you live, if you go out, especially this past weekend, if you went out to a park or to a statue or a fountain in your neighborhood, I bet you saw a dozen people trying to catch Pokemon.
Right. And apparently there are reports of a few erratic drivers moving at speeds of around 5 miles per hour and making frequent
more
stops.
More than one Department of Transportation has taken to Twitter or Facebook to encourage people not to be catching Pokemon while they drive. I think that's particularly important for those of you in Los Angeles.
And there's also been reports of robberies, right? Because large groups of people are playing this game at night with their phones right out there.
Well, the really clever, you know, obviously any mugger can just mug somebody who's staring at their phone, but the really clever robbers, these three guys near St. Louis who set up a beacon and were luring people into their area to try to catch Pokemon in a parking lot where they then
dastardly would rob. Plan.
It was clever, though. It's entrepreneurial, I would say.
Well, I read an essay on Medium this weekend from an African-American man, a contributor, and he was wandering around aimlessly in his neighborhood at 10:30 at night looking for Pokemon, holding his phone out in front of him. And he suddenly realized that someone was very likely to call the cops on him and that a phone can easily be mistaken for a gun.
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect to the real life part of this, which is that video games are escapist, and one thing that's always made them a home for people who might otherwise feel threatened out in the real world is that you don't have to be out in the real world. This is a game that you actually need to be out in the real world to play, and on the one hand, that means that it can bring up certain obviously terrible, real world interactions, but it can also mean that you are surrounded suddenly by a bunch of people who are kind of in on the same big secret that you are.
Well, do you think the game has lasting power? Or will no one be talking about Pokemon Go next week?
It's hard to say. I think that it's going to fall off a little bit, as fads like this always do. But it's hard not to see how much fun people are having playing this. And the truth is, the game is a little bit janky right now. So I can only imagine what it would be like when the servers are up and running all the time and when the game kind of works. I think really what we're seeing is a model for any number of different games or even new kinds of entertainment and stories. You know, it's the kind of thing I look at it and just how big this has become. It seems like it's only a matter of time before we get another sort of a mainstream version of this that pushes off a television show or even is its own story that's sort of a treasure hunt style, what they call an alternate reality game.
And then we really, if it's a crime show, we really will have people out there maybe playing around with their phones and toy guns.
Yeah, that's when I'm going to stay in my basement. Play old-fashioned video games.
Max Reed, he's senior editor of the Select All tech blog at New York Magazine. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pokemon Go players, where is the most ridiculous place you found a Pokemon? That's what we're asking. Tweet us at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, as a feminist writer and blogger, Jessica Valenti has experienced all kinds of online hate and objectification.
There was a time, if you did a Google search on my name, it said, are you searching for Jessica Valenti Breast? It was one of the related searches that came up for my name, which was, it was completely humiliating.
Sex Object, a memoir with author Jessica Valenti. That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
You're listening to Press Play on KZRW. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Madeline Brand. When Jessica Valenti was 12, a man masturbated in front of her on a New York subway station platform. As she tells in her new memoir, it was just the first of many similar episodes, and I think many women listening can relate to this. Growing up in New York, her teens were filled with men pushing themselves up against her in crowded subway cars, flashing her, or making suggestive comments. As a young adult, Valenti started writing about women's issues and launched the website Feministing. And these days, she writes a column on gender and politics for The Guardian US. And as a well-known feminist, writer, and blogger, she continues to attract the attention of men, often in online comments too ugly and offensive to be repeated on the radio. In Sex Object, a memoir, Valenti connects the dots between her childhood experiences and her adult self. And it is a real pleasure to talk with you on Press Play.
Thank you for having me.
So as I just implied, most women have stories about being groped or flashed or hissed at by strange men. I've been flashed two or three times. Mm-hmm. But you, from age 12 and throughout your teens, it sounds like, from what you write, that it happened to you all the time. Do you think that is about growing up in New York?
I think part of it is. I do think that probably the sort of everyday nature of the street harassment and the flashing and the groping was somewhat New York City related or city related, public transportation related. But from the response that I've gotten to the book, it's really not an unusual experience that young women have, unfortunately, still even.
And that experience that you have over and over amounts to something that you write about. And this is a quote. You say, mm-hmm. We still have no name for what happens to women living in a culture that hates them. We, meaning women, are sick people mm-hmm. with no disease, given no explanation for our supposedly disconnected symptoms. And I think that's such an interesting insight that gets to two things about swimming in this kind of atmosphere mm-hmm. for women. And one is that society doesn't even recognize that what we perceive as intense hostility on many levels is significant and has an effect on us. And the other, that we don't understand it ourselves. And my question for you is this true of all women, that we're all sick from this nameless disease? Because it does affect some of us much more than others.
Right. I mean, I think that that's right. I think that it, living in a sexist world means different things for different women. And I would never want to speak for all women, obviously. But what I was trying to get at in the book and with that sentiment specifically is this idea of the cumulative impact of sexism, right? You know, we have language for specific instances of harassment. When someone is sexually assaulted, we call them a survivor. But we don't have a language, we don't have a conversation going about what that all snowballs into, right? Like the everyday sexisms, the small pieces of harassment, but that we face over years and over a lifetime. And what that does to, you know, us emotionally, psychologically, and how it shapes who we are, really.
And I want to pick apart that quote a little bit more because words do matter, and you do use the word hate. And I guess my question is a culture, and it's not just American culture, a culture that objectifies women sexually, is that a culture that hates women?
I mean, I think that objectification in itself is a form of disdain, right? Objectifying someone is a way of dehumanizing someone. And when someone is not considered a person, it becomes easier to do violence to them, to harass them, to hurt them. So I do consider that, you know, a part of misogyny. But there are so many different aspects of misogyny, unfortunately, that go beyond objectification. And I think that if you talk to most women, they do have that feeling of living in a world that is extraordinarily hostile to them.
Well, let's talk about one of the examples of objectification that you experienced. Mm. In 2006, you got invited to meet President Bill Clinton, and you were in a group photo with him. And it should have been a proud moment for you. And in fact, your parents put the clipping with the photo up on the wall behind the cash register in their clothing store. But you tell us what happened then.
Sure. It was a very innocuous group photo. I had been invited to go with a group of bloggers, and I was, you know, in my 20s at the time. It was very exciting. But afterwards, when the photo was published, a blogger made some comments about the way I looked and, you know, calling me, you know, the intern with the dark hair. And when I sort of commented back nastily about that, it snowballed into this sort of online controversy. You know, hundreds of blogs covered it. I got maybe 1,000 emails, and the whole controversy was whether or not my shirt was too tight and whether or not somehow I was sticking my chest out or trying to look seductive in this photo with.
And it became all about your breasts. And
it became all about my breasts.
And how did you react to this? Because you do tell a lot of other stories in the book. Was it like deja vu all over again for you? This breastgate, Jessica Valenti,
breastgate. You know, and I wrote in the book, there was a time, if you did a Google search on my name, it said, "Are you searching for Jessica Valenti breast?" It was one of the related searches that came up for my name, which was, you know, it was completely humiliating. But a lot of young women online experience this sort of harassment and this sort of focus on their body, people taking them less seriously because they're women, because they look a certain way, talking about their bodies in circumstances that have nothing to do with their bodies. Again, it's so commonplace.
I'm talking to author Jessica Valenti about her new book, Sex Object, a memoir. I think there's a really important conflict that you get to, a tension that you get to in the book, that on the one hand, you disparage the idea of women being treated like objects. But at the same time, you and many women are very concerned about being attractive to men. And it's just this essential contradiction that every woman understands, I think, but men have a harder time with. Can you talk to that tension?
Sure. I mean, it is difficult, right? I mean, on the one hand, there is nothing wrong with wanting to look attractive to someone you are trying to attract, right? Like that, there's a sort of like a base human level to that. But on the other hand, there's so much that women have to do to themselves in order to be considered sort of not horrible, like, you know, like the waxing and the tweezing and the makeup. And there is a conflict. You know, I'm a feminist. I write about feminist issues every day. I also wear makeup and feel better about myself when I do wear makeup. I have no illusions as to why that is. I understand that that's sort of a negotiation that I'm making in a sexist world. And I think that we all have to sort out what negotiations we're comfortable with.
Well, yeah, negotiation is a good word because you have, on the one hand, you want to look presentable, you want to look good enough to pass because you know the world is always judging you, as we mm-hmm. see in, and objectifying you, as we see in your example about the photo op. But at the same time, you don't want to look like you're asking for it. And that's the victim shaming side of this.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing about victim blaming is that no matter what a woman looks like, she's likely to be, you know, unfortunately, she is victim blamed. You know, you see survivors of harassment and assault who are wearing skirts or who are wearing pajamas who are victim blamed in some ways. And if it's not about what they're wearing, it's about what they're doing. But, you know, the other piece about wanting to look a certain way or, you know, engaging with objectification in a way that some people might find contradictory is that, you know, there is a power there. If you're a girl and you grow up as a woman, you are given a really limited amount of power in the world. But one of the ways that we do have access to power is through the way we look, the way we present our sexuality. That stinks. That's not, you know, that's not wonderful. But I also think that it's not a great use of our time to shame women who make use of that power.
Well, and that leads me directly to what I wanted to talk to you about in terms of power mm-hmm. and shaming women who use that power. When I talk with young women who identify as feminists today, mm-hmm. we almost always get into a conversation about the Kim Kardashian effect, that she sure. is a feminist icon because she subverts mm-hmm. the system of male domination by taking control of her own sexuality and mm-hmm. owning it and commodifying it. Beyonce, too, you know, and that she's mm-hmm. changing society by saying I'm not transgressing mm-hmm. by putting my sexuality out there. Mm-hmm. So at the same time, I'm always the older generation blathering about why aren't you idolizing RBG and Ruth Bader Ginsburg sure. instead? Is that the conversation that you have with young women as well? And what do you think of this?
Somewhat. I mean, but I have to say, I do think that a younger generation idolizes Ruth Bader Ginsburg, right? Like there's that Tumblr dedicated to her. There is a lot of, you know, love for her there. You know, but I think it's interesting. I consider the images and the self-presentation of Beyonce and Kim Kardashian to be very different. I see Beyonce as someone who very carefully and consciously constructs an image for herself, right? Whereas Kim Kardashian, it seems the impact to me comes more from the outside. And I think that that's an important distinction. And I think that's what a lot of younger feminists are interested in and trying to get at. For them, the narrative of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be sexy, has very much been controlled by men in the past. And now, especially with social media, selfies, right, this has become a way for women to take control of that narrative and create their own images of what it means to be sexy. Now, does that mean that it's divorced from the context of misogyny and sexism and the male gaze? No, of course not. It's not. But it's a start. And I think it's really interesting that younger women are having this conversation and thinking about this in a critical way.
Well, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about how, as a blogger and a feminist writer and talking about these subjects, you continue to get a lot of abuse on the internet. And you printed a number of comments in the back of the book. And many of them I can't read on the radio, yeah. but just a sample. Why haven't you had your ovaries, et cetera, removed yet? And curse, 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 you damn whore. Why are so many hardcore feminists so unattractive? And finally, you're one heck of a disgusting, ugly-looking hag. I hope some Mack truck crashes head-on into you. I'm sorry to pile them up like that. Do you still read people's comments? And how does it affect you?
You know, I try to avoid them now. But, you know, part of the problem with ignoring them, and I think a lot of women who write online struggle with this issue, is that you have to read them somewhat because it's important to know if someone is threatening you in a way that you should take seriously and report, right? So you can ignore it, but then maybe something important will go pass by. I try not to pay attention to it as much as possible. For a long time, I engaged with it. I think a lot of female writers engage with it. And I do think that it takes something out of you. You know, I've been doing this work. I've been writing online for over 10 years. And when you're getting called really horrible names that are almost entirely reserved for women every day for years on end, that does something to you, that does something to who you are. But the bigger concern I have is not just, you know, for myself and what it's done to me in my life, but what that means for future generations of writers, not just women, but folks from other marginalized groups who also get harassed online. When I go to speak on college campuses, which I do quite often, I hear from younger folks who say, you know, I thought I was going to be a writer. I thought I was going to be a journalist. I thought I was going to be an activist of some sort online, but I see the abuse you take, and now I'm not willing to do it. Hmm. And you can't say to them, do it anyway, because it'll be fine, because you don't know that it will be fine. And I think to a really large degree, we're losing out on an incredible generation of talent from marginalized groups, of women, because of this harassment and because we haven't figured out a way to battle it.
Jessica Valenti, she's a columnist for The Guardian US and the author of Sex Object, a memoir. I really enjoyed talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on our show, a bonanza of new crime dramas this week. We'll hear about the recently leaked first episode of the cybercrime series, Mr. Robot, also HBO's The Night Of, and an 80s throwback thriller, The Stranger Within, with Winona Ryder. That's next on Press Play.
Select sessions from KCRW's music program, Morning Becomes Eclectic, can be experienced in the immersive world of virtual reality. Download KCRW's VR app to get lost in the music. Go to kcrw.com/VR.
This is Press Play. Barbara Bogave in for Madeline Brand. The new season of Mr. Robot is set to premiere on Wednesday, but during a live Facebook Q&A with cast members last night, a masked figure appeared on screen, and then the season's first episode began to play. The leaked episode then started popping up on other social media platforms. It seemed Mr. Robot had been hacked. Yeah, right. Of course, it was a marketing stunt for the USA series about a vigilante computer hacker. Alan Sepinwall is here to talk about it. He's TV critic for the entertainment news website HitFix. And it's great to talk with you, Alan.
Thanks for having me.
All right, fans of Mr. Robot, and I count myself among them, we were treated to the first half of the first episode of this season. Is this a good marketing ploy in the age of BitTorrent?
Well, I mean, they did this with the first season, too. Not quite to this sort of this screener will self-destruct, you know, digital ambush method. But the first episode of season one was available, I think, about a month before it debuted. They screened it at South By. Then they put it online on demand. I remember I watched it even weeks before there was an official screener for it. So it helps build up anticipation. And in this case, it's a two-hour premiere. So even if people tuned in, were able to watch on Twitter or Snapchat or wherever last night, they're still going to have to watch the other hour on Wednesday, so it's a pretty diabolical sort of way to bait the hook for season two.
But my big question for you is whether, without this big reveal of the last season, I don't want to spoil it for anyone who didn't watch the first season, is there enough dramatic tension to keep Mr. Robot going in the second season?
I think there is, just because Rami Malek is still on Mr. Robot, and this is one of the best performances in all of television, and he's so good, and the way that the show around him that Sam Esmail writes and is now directing every episode, the way it looks and just the feel of it, it's still special regardless of what's happening. And one of the things we see both in the episode that was dropped on social media last night and in the second hour is that even though F Society claimed what they thought was this big victory over, you know, evil corporate America, it's not quite that simple. And so I think there's still a lot of places for it to go. But frankly, like if it was Rami Malek, you know, I would say reading the phone book, but that's a really dated reference, especially for this show. If it was Rami Malek reading, you know, a cereal box, I would watch that.
I would watch him hacking anything. Just click.
Exactly.
Well, USA is not the only network to give viewers a preview of an upcoming show. HBO released the first episode of its new series, The Night Of, more than 2 weeks ago, before it premiered last night. And I'd like to play a clip from that first episode. It's titled The Beach.
What you need to understand is what you say to me here is very important for you, not me. It can help you. I'm trying to help you. Help me help you.
I can't breathe.
Okay. It's okay. Not uncommon. Just relax.
No, I mean, I have asthma.
Oh. You got something to help you with that?
No.
You want to go to the hospital?
I want to go home.
That's the actor Riz Ahmed in the role of Nas being interrogated by a police detective. And what's the subject of the interrogation?
Nas has woken up in the bed of a woman he met the night before, and she is very, very dead. And there's a lot of evidence pointing to him having done it, and he blacked out, so even he's not sure if he did.
So he is not sure. He kind of went beyond his comfort zone in this evening, and a lot of things happened that he can't keep track of. Kind of reminded me of Marcella, another series in which a police officer, in that case, she has blackouts. And The Night Of was supposed to star James Gandolfini, and he's still credited as an executive producer of the series. And HBO almost didn't move forward with it after Gandolfini's death, right? But it has some really talented people associated with it, like Richard Price, the author of the novels Clockers and Freedomland. Do you think it was the right move to go ahead with the series without Gandolfini?
I think it was. I mean, Gandolfini, he's an executive producer in part because that was part of his deal when he was going to star, but also because he pushed for HBO to do this and to adapt it from the British show Criminal Justice. And I think, like, they decided pretty quickly after he passed away that they wanted to keep it going as a tribute to him. The problem then became finding an actor to replace Gandolfini, and how do you replace the biggest star in HBO history? And they got Robert De Niro, and then there was a scheduling conflict, and eventually they brought in John Turturro, who is both a great actor and friends with Gandolfini, and he shows up briefly in the episode that aired last night, and I've seen the first 7 of the 8 hours, and he is really exceptional, and, you know, it would have been awesome, obviously, to have Jim around and doing this, but Turturro's pretty spectacular, as is the whole show.
Well, some have been saying that HBO has a drama problem since Vinyl and True Detective Season 2 were so disappointing. In the ratings. Can this series, you think, help HBO prove it's still great, the best at prestige drama?
I think it can help certainly temporarily. The reaction so far, both from when they previewed it and when it aired last night, has been for the most part hugely positive, and it has that feel of those classic HBO shows where just people are going to be talking about it and talking about it. The only issue is it's a limited series. It's going to run 8 episodes, and that's probably it. There's a chance that they might sort of turn it into an anthology miniseries like True Detective, like American Horror Story, or some of these other things. But we don't know yet. As of now, all we're supposed to get is those 8. So still, you're going to have the problem. Once Leftovers ends, Game of Thrones is going to be the only returning HBO drama as of now.
Well, speaking of prestige drama, a home for that is Netflix, and they have a new original series premiering this week called Stranger Things, starring Winona Ryder. Why don't you tell us the premise?
It is both a tribute to early 80s, like Steven Spielberg, Stephen King, John Carpenter, horror adventure kind of movies, and set in that time. So Winona Ryder plays the mom of a kid who goes missing in a small town in Indiana, and his nerdy Dungeons and Dragons playing friends are trying to find him, and she's trying to find him, and there's a monster in another dimension and a little girl with special powers and a secret government program, and it's sort of blending together all of those things that especially if you were a kid in 1983, are going to speak strongly to you, but hopefully for Netflix's sake will also speak well to people who were born even after that.
We can hope, but I am still living in the 80s in some way, and I think Winona Ryder, she's like our touchstone for the 80s. I wonder how long this will keep going. Will she keep playing moms and then grandmoms when she's like 60
and throwback 80s? And we all get older, and the business makes actresses get older than actors pretty quickly, so it's a really good performance from her. She hasn't been around a lot lately, but between Show Me a Hero and HBO last summer and now this, it's not quite a transition into adulthood because she'd already done that, but it's a nice little return from a hiatus, whether self-imposed or not, and she's really very good in this. It's a lot of fun.
Alan Sepinwalli is a TV critic for the entertainment news website HitFix, and that was fun. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Jolie Myers. Are you playing Pokemon Go right now?
Not right now.
Until 2 seconds ago, you were.
I'm thinking about it right now. I accidentally got addicted to Pokemon Go today. I was the producer on that segment earlier in the show, and I was like, well, I better download it just to see what it's like to play.
All right.
So that I wasn't introducing any sort of errors into the script or anything like that, and was immediately sucked in, and now I can't stop playing it.
Does that mean we don't have any feedback from listeners, though?
No, and you want to know why we have a lot of feedback today?
Why?
Because I'm not alone, Barbara. There are many people who have gotten addicted to Pokemon. First, I want to share my favorite story of the unintended consequences of Pokemon Go. Apparently, there's one of these Pokemon Go nodes called a Pokemon Gym, and it's centered right over the Westboro Baptist Church.
No.
You've heard of these people.
So this brings in people from all over.
So it brings in people from all over trying to collect this very rare Clefairy or something like that.
Ministers everywhere should take
note
of this.
And so obviously the Westboro Baptist Church is completely horrified by all this, but I find that level of Pokemon trolling pretty hilarious. We asked our listeners where some of the fun places they've collected Pokemon Go characters. Bottles for Charlemagne says that they got a dope Charmander in Golden Gate Park this weekend. Danny Sway, one of our volunteer coordinators, says that he had a magical night at the Hollywood Bowl watching Brian Wilson and caught an Abra. It's a magic type Pokemon. augmented reality.
Just what the band thinks of these people making these weird little swipes everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing to hold your phone up like the modern day lighter at a concert. It's another if you're doing
another
that.
To catch an orange dragon Pokemon.
A Pokemon. Yeah. I don't know any of the names of them except Charmander and
Squirtle. I remember Squirtle from way back.
All right. You won, Barbara. You're going to catch them all.
Well, I think that does it for us for
it does.
Today. Yeah, that's it. I'm Barbara Bogave. Madeline will be back tomorrow, and I hope you'll join her. And also stay with us for Warren Olney, back from vacation, and he's coming up next on To The Point here on KCRW and KCRW.com.